Desai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Hi Ram, and welcome dear listeners to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem as always coming to you live from our studios in Radio Sai and Radio Sai Answering Booth. It's a program that we, me and you listeners do together, don't we? We have had many questions on the show and from a variety of themes. And continuing that trend, we will be having two questions on this show too, which are quite different from the ones we have handled so far. They are short questions but profound nonetheless. But it's not yet time for the questions because I'm yet to share with you my quote of the day, isn't it? So here comes another gem from the literary trove of Rabindranath Tagore. Yes, listeners, it's a quote from Tagore. So let me first read it out to you. And the quote is as follows. The small wisdom is like water in a glass, clear, transparent, pure. The great wisdom is like the water in the sea, dark, mysterious and impenetrable. Let me repeat that quote again for you. The small wisdom is like water in a glass, clear, transparent and pure. The great wisdom is like the water in the sea, dark, mysterious and impenetrable. Now isn't that a very profound quote? But exactly what does Tagore mean by small wisdom and great wisdom? Some of you would often say, don't try to understand me, just experience me. Why would Swami say that? It is because it's impossible for our little minds to wrap around the vastness of His reality, right? But still, we always are trying to understand what Swami would want us to do, how Swami will want us to respond to a particular situation, right? So one hand, we believe that we can never comprehend Swami. But on the other hand, we are actually able to get clarity when we think this way. Our minds and intellects are like those little containers. Swami's wisdom is like the ocean, and the ocean is itself unfathomable. It is believed that we still know very little about our oceans in spite of all our progress we've made in science. But when we fetch the same ocean water in a small container, or when we scoop out some water with our intellects, that water is clear and transparent. It looks like the qualities of the water itself changes when we take out a small quantity in a glass. Similarly, we could sometimes get overwhelmed when we consider all the wisdom in the world, and we have this habit of worrying about concepts which most times only confuse us. But if we take as much as we need, the clarity that comes out of it can guide our actions. Of course, there is a corollary to that. It is very easy to understand the actions of a man with finite wisdom. He has a clear idea of what is good and bad, right and wrong, and so his actions are simple to understand. But when you see a master of infinite wisdom like Swami, who is wisdom personified, if I can say so, it is very difficult to understand his actions. Because when there is so much knowledge, his actions will be performed taking into account a number of angles and factors which our little wisdom we can never comprehend. That is why Swami would say, don't try to understand me, experience me and be blissful. Anubhavinchu, anandinchu. So let me read that quote one more time for all of you. The small wisdom is like water in a glass. The small wisdom is like water in a glass, clear, transparent and pure. The great wisdom is like water in the sea, dark, mysterious and impenetrable. Alright then, let us get to the questions for the day. We have two questions as always, both, as I said, are short ones. They were both mailed to me, so I will myself be reading out the questions. The first question for the day is from Mr. Vineet Sharma. Okay, let me read the question out for you first. I have been initiated from Ramakrishna Mission and do Japa Dhyana with my Ishtam or chosen form as Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. But at the same time, I have love for Swami's form. I get sometimes so confused on the form while doing Japa Dhyana. Would you kindly solve my imbroglio? Thank you, Brother Vineet, for that question. Straight answer to that question. Swami says you can choose any form and name for your of your liking for Japa and Dhyana. That is contemplation and meditation. So there is as such no restriction that if you are a Swami's devotee, you have to meditate only on Swami or say Shirdi Baba or any such thing. But if you have been following this program, no answer is so short. That's because I take the opportunity to speak a little more about the concept the question is related to. And I would like to do the same here too. Because though I am saying any form is acceptable, I think it will be helpful if I explain why any form is okay and how do you actually choose a form and under what circumstances, if any, you change the form you meditate upon after a period of time. And needless to say, all this is based on Swami's teachings. Why is it that any form is acceptable? Truly speaking, divinity is formless and it is we who attribute a form to God. Or in the case of an avatar, though the Lord chooses a form, it is we who restrict him to that form when he is always beyond the form that he himself adorns. The second reason is, whatever be the form we choose, true meditation involves transcending the form at some time or the other. So that makes it quite immaterial what form one chooses to meditate upon. In fact, some people say you can even meditate on your thumb and Jyoti meditation is something we have heard Swami speak about. But there is a reason why it is better to meditate on a deity of your choice than a lifeless object. But I'll come to that a little later in the answer. But the question arises, if it does not matter what form we meditate upon, and if eventually we have to take our meditation to the formless state, why meditate upon a form at all? Let me give a quick explanation of what is meditation or dhyana as explained by Swami and our scriptures. Swami talks of the process of meditation itself being made up of three processes: concentration, contemplation, and meditation. Where the true meditation is only in the final stage, just closing eyes and doing japam or concentrating on a form is not really meditation. The form is very important for the first stage in the process, which is concentration. Swami says there are three states the mind goes through. These are no-pointedness, multi-pointedness, and one-pointedness. No-pointedness is when we are asleep, which is quite useless in the context of meditation. Multi-pointedness is the state we are in throughout the day when we engage in a variety of activities. And one-pointedness is a state when we are really concentrating on something. And even as I say that, you will agree that we could use one-pointedness or concentration even in our day-to-day activities, right? When we study or while we are doing some important work or reading, or for that matter, even our mundane activities. This is one way meditation helps, because it improves concentration even when we go about doing our other works. Why is it difficult to concentrate? Because our head is full of so many thoughts and this mind is like a monkey that keeps jumping from one branch to the other. So as a first step, we choose a place and time, sit down in an assigned posture, choose any form of our choice and try to concentrate on it. When we do Jyoti meditation, we actually sit and stare at that flame to start with. Because seeing it slowly enables us to concentrate on that form and removes all other thoughts and forms from the mind. It is very helpful when there is some form. It can be that of Krishna, Rama, the cross, the Kaaba, the form of your own guru. Swami, as I mentioned, some people say you can concentrate even on your thumb. Why? Because you carry your thumb always with you. The next stage is contemplation. where you don't need a physical representation of that form, because you don't need the physical representation of that form before you. The form is imprinted in your mind and you concentrate on that form that has formed in your mind. So the stage of contemplation contains in it concentration too. Of course, most of us who practice meditation don't need to look at a picture or idol, right? So does that mean we have gone to this stage of contemplation? To an extent, yes. When one is truly in the stage of contemplation, the physical conditions we spoke of, as an appointed place and time, a quiet environment and so on, will not also be necessary, just as physical image or an idol is not necessary for concentrating upon. Even when in a crowded, noisy place, you should be able to meditate. Then maybe we can say your practice of meditation has reached the second stage. Finally, meditation is that stage where you don't need the form at all. In this stage, the one who meditates, the dhyata, the form being meditated upon, the dhyaya, the process of meditation, dhyana, merge to become one. This is the highest form of meditation. And this is in fact true meditation. And it is only in this stage the form becomes redundant. In an interview that Swami gave to some students, Swami asked, "So how many of you do meditation?" Now the senior boys who were there knew Swami's definition of meditation and they knew it is best to keep quiet. But there was one new student in that group who very enthusiastically put up his hand. And Swami also looked at him with all excitement and said, "Oh, so you do meditation?" The boy said, "Yes, yes, Swami, I do every morning." Swami then asked him, "For how much time do you do?" The boy said, "Swami, I do for 20 minutes or something like that. Then Swami told him, "Dunnapota, if you really are doing meditation, you will never know for how long you are doing." That's what Swami said. Of course, after that Swami told that boy that it is good, he's trying, but then told him what is true meditation. When the one who meditates vanishes, how will there be awareness of time and space? That is true meditation. So sum and substance of what I've said so far, you need some form to meditate upon, though you will have to transcend that form eventually. People say, why not then meditate upon the formless or nirguna or nirakara? Because anyway you're going to go to the formless. The fact is, it is not possible. When you say I meditate upon the formless, your mind is giving that attribute to what you are meditating upon. Your description that it is formless also becomes an attribute, and so it is no more nirguna, it is saguna. Swami says our mind is under the influence of the gunas. It can see everything only from that perspective. Like when you all fill an online form, let's say, you will either fill in some details in the form or you should type in none in the category mentioned. Though I am typing in none there, the computer will always read that also as an entry. Similarly, when I say formless, that is also an attribute I am giving to what I am meditating upon. The way to really go beyond the form is to fill the mind with one form through concentration and contemplation, and then the mind and the form vanish together. So take any form of your choice, but Swami also says, stick to that form. Don't keep changing your form. For the simple reason, if we keep changing the form, it becomes difficult for reaching the first stage of one-pointed concentration itself. It's a very simple technique actually. You know, there is this famous experiment called Pavlov's experiment. What the scientist Pavlov does is that every time he places food before his dog, he rings a bell. Now when you generally put food before the dog starts salivating, right? And that's what the dog does. But when over a period of time he did this bell ringing every time he placed food before the dog's mind built a connection between the ringing sound and food. And it happens subconsciously. After a few days, when this scientist rang the bell, the dog starts salivating inadvertently, even though there is no food placed before it. This happens with us too. Why do you think we have this practice of the incense sticks burning in the puja room and so on? Or for that matter, the bell in a church or a temple? In those days, the cities used to be built around the temple or church. Whenever the main puja is happening, they would ring the bell. and the people in the city, even if not in the temple, will be able to think of God the moment they hear the bell ringing. We try to attain something similar in the practice of meditation too. So that after a regular practice, the moment you sit down in your place set aside for meditation, the moment you close your eyes, the chosen form will come in your mind's eye spontaneously. So the stage of concentration and contemplation can be attained without much effort. So it is necessary to have one form or one name and contemplate on it if we wish to do meditation. And that is how we attain one-pointedness, isn't it? But there is one condition under which the form can be changed. But to explain that, let me first talk about another categorization of meditation that Swami has himself given. Swami calls it the three paths of meditation in the Dhyana Vahini, and they are the sattvic, the rajasic, and the tamasic path. These paths more or less relate to meditation on a particular form or a name of God. Let us start with the tamasic path. People who follow this path take to the repetition of the name and contemplation of the form when in trouble or in fear and not otherwise. If the exam season starts and you start doing japam and dhyanam, this is the path you follow. You know, when I was in school, I, like most Indian children, would like to play cricket. And we would travel as a team playing with other schools. Now, when I used to be batting against a spinner or a slower bowler, the only thought in my mind would be, I'm going to step down and hit him for a 4 or 6. But then there would be these very fast bowlers who were very difficult to face. The moment such bowlers would come before me, I recall automatically in my mind, Namasmarna will start. Ram, Ram, Ram. Swami says, this is exactly what is the tamasic path. The next is the rajasic approach. This is when we take to meditation with a goal in mind. We want to achieve something. It could be something as simple as peace of mind or concentration or something higher like a mindless state or some such spiritual experience. Swami says that when we take up meditation with such an attitude, there is the chance that over time the interest might fade away if no such experience comes forth. And also your mind is all the time thinking of the benefit that comes. So all people who do meditation as a spiritual practice, even with a non-worldly spiritual benefit in mind, come under this category. But the best path is the sattvic approach. When one does meditation without any benefit in mind, and when does this happen? When you enjoy the process of meditation itself, isn't it? And when will we enjoy the process itself? One sure way is when you have spontaneous love for the form you are meditating upon, and you enjoy contemplating on that name and form. Some would sometimes say that unknown to them, the Gopikas were practicing the highest form of meditation. This is how it is. They did not have to sit and think of Krishna. They did not have to go to a temple. They loved Krishna so much that every object they would see in some way would remind them of Krishna. And when they would hear Krishna's flute, their minds would be so tuned that they would not even think of the consequences. They would run to the banks of Yamuna. This type of contemplation that comes out of devotion and love, not for receiving anything, not for attaining any state, but just because nothing gives me more joy than thinking of my Lord. This, Swami says, is the best path of meditation. So if anyone has chosen a particular form for japa and dhyana, say in the case of this question itself, here Brother Vineet, you say you were initiated with a certain name and form. But now, if you say after coming to Swami, you feel immense love for Swami, and when you close your eyes, Swami's image comes inadvertently, be sure that is the best form of meditation. Not because it is Swami's form, but because your contemplation now comes out of love for the joy of contemplation and not for achieving anything. I feel that is one instance when it is okay to change the name and form of worship or meditation. There are many of Swami's devotees who have gone through this transition. So let me try and summarize whatever I've said so far. It really does not matter what form and name you meditate upon, because one, all names and forms belong to the same Lord. And secondly, whatever be the form you take up, true meditation is when you go beyond that form itself. Then I explained why it is necessary to stick to one form, as it is more easier to attain the stages of concentration and contemplation when we have fixed a name and form, even though all names and forms are equally valid. In the last part, I refer to what Swami speaks of as the three paths of meditation. Thinking of the name and form when in trouble is the lowest. Doing meditation with a benefit in mind, even spiritual benefit, is the second path. But the best is when one contemplates on a name and form with no desire for a result, but does so spontaneously and derives joy from the act of contemplation itself. So it is okay if one chooses to take a different form because of true devotion to that form. For people like me and many others who spend some time with Swami, even though we would chant other names and meditate on other forms, after coming to Swami, it is much more easier to relate to this form and name because of the love we have received from Swami. So when we change to meditating on Swami, it is not wrong. So Brother Vineet, if you think this form is less powerful and that form is... will give me more benefit, so let me shift to that form, I think then it would become a mistake. So dear listeners, actually my answer ends here, but I would like to share one beautiful analogy that Swami would give to explain concentration, contemplation and meditation. It is really so profound that I can't resist the temptation of sharing it with you in this context. Swami would say, there is a rose growing in a bush. There, apart from the rose, there are leaves, stems and thorns. But when you want to pluck it, you first identify where it is, and that act of identifying where the rose is concentration. When you look at the rose, all other parts of the plant blur away, right? Once you concentrate, you can pluck the rose without being hurt by the thorns. Once the rose is plucked, there is no relationship between the flower and the thorns and leaves and so on. This is contemplation, where the rose is removed from its surroundings, or better put, the surroundings are removed from the rose. Then comes the beautiful part. You now go and place this flower as an offering before God. Once you offer it, the bush with leaves and thorns don't exist in your mind. Even the flower doesn't exist in your hand after the offering is made. God alone exists. And this is meditation. I have nothing more to say. Is there any topic that Swami has not explained in a manner that our simple minds cannot understand? Expressing gratitude to Swami for such wisdom and thanking Brother Vineet for sending us that question, I complete this answer. If you have any more questions to ask on the same topic, Brother Vineet, do write to me again. The next question has come to us from the Himalayan country of Nepal. Brother Naresh has written to us with a question that is pretty philosophical, but let us listen to that and see if we can give an answer which can be of practical relevance too. So here's the question, and as I said, I'm going to be reading it out for you today. When do we feel peace? Do we have any desire at that particular moment when we feel peace? If yes, what are they? Please give at least three examples if there are more. If these are more, if we do not have any desire at that particular moment when we feel peace, it may be for a few seconds, then who are we at that particular moment? So that is a question from Brother Naresh from Nepal. Thank you, Brother, for that question. The way you've put forth your question itself suggests that there is a strong relationship between peace and desires, and that's absolutely right. But the question is, do we get peace after satisfying desires or after removing desires? And can desires and peace coexist? But before we come to that, I would like to define the peace I'm going to talk about. The ultimate peace comes when the mind is completely silenced, or as they say, when there are no chitta vrittis. If the mind is to be compared to a pond, chitta vrittis can be compared to waves or ripples that are created in it. It is said our minds are never silent and there is some thought or other going on all the time. And the only time we go through that stillness is when in a deep sleep state. And as some great masters say, when we can live that deep sleep state when awake, we will be in that ultimate peace. The other peace which we talk of is the peace that the mind itself experiences. Now that peace is something we all know about, and I will mostly be referring to that peace. But just remember this analogy of the pond and the chittavrittis or disturbances of the mind to be ripples. Maybe we'll come back to that later. I don't think there is any better place to start than Swami's quote explaining how to attain peace, right? Swami would say, I want peace. I is ego, want is desire. And when you remove ego and desire, you have peace. So how can we understand this explanation of Swami and also practice it? For that, we must understand, in what form do we experience peace in everyday life? Peace is experienced as satisfaction. Though we often define peace as being calm and serene, we actively experience peace when we experience satisfaction. And that is why we speak of desires when we speak of peace. Desire is a sign of dissatisfaction or craving. And when there is craving, there cannot be peace. So if peace is satisfaction, then all that we have to do is keep satisfying our desires. Then we can experience peace, right? Well, if that is the case, why is Swami asking us to remove desires? Instead, we can have more desires and find more peace by satisfaction, by satisfying all of them, isn't it? Let us say that you have some stomach pain. You go to a doctor seeking relief from the pain. The doctor gives you a medicine and gives immediate relief. But then the doctor tells you, this medicine relieves you from pain, but tomorrow you will have more pain. But don't worry, you come back to me, I will give you the same medicine, and then you will have relief for some time, but the next day you will have more pain. Will we be interested in such a treatment? Rather, we will want a treatment that ensures the pain does not occur again. Desires are like that pain. And if we keep trying to satisfy desires, they will only keep multiplying. Swami would often explain that desires are like the itching sensation that comes along with eczema. If you scratch when it itches, it gives satisfaction for a short while, but then the itching only increases. But it is a fact that for a short while, you have satisfaction and so feel peace. So the key is, we feel satisfaction or peace when we are fulfilled. When we have a desire satisfied, the mind acknowledges that a certain fulfillment has been found and so feels, I am satisfied. But there are many such small aspects in our own life that are someone else's aspiration or desire. Simple things like 3 square meals a day, a roof to sleep under, a steady income or any number of such things. Ask yourself how many people are there in the world craving for those simple things. The more we remind ourselves of such blessings, the more we will experience peace. This is a very easy way for us to experience peace. I always think of this. When you have some ailment in the body, it is called disease. The word disease means dis-ease or the lack of ease. When we have a disease and we are cured, we return to ease and feel very peaceful. So it is a cycle from ease to disease back to ease. And we acknowledge only the ease after the disease. That is why we feel or experience peace at that point. If we learn to acknowledge the ease that comes before something goes wrong, or in other words, the joy of just being normally healthy, won't we be experiencing peace? Even when performing simple functions, if we remind ourselves, how happy I am to be able to do this. I'm grateful for this blessing. You can experience peace at that moment itself. And you will agree with me, if we are able to do this honestly, I'm sure each one of us will have more reasons to be in peace than to be disturbed. If we make this a habit, what happens to our desires? To start with, desires will slowly lose their sting. The craving will not disturb your peace as much because we have increased our general level of peace. Then with time, the mind will learn that there can be fulfillment and satisfaction even when a desire is not fulfilled. Let me put it this way. Desire is nothing but a craving for a state that is different from the present state. Let's say I desire a new car. This means my mind is liking that state of me with a new car over the present moment, which is me without a new car. So in that sense, desire and craving is always a dissatisfaction with what is the current state. The more and more we learn to be happy in the present with the state we are in, the lesser the desires will affect our peace of mind. So desires may become targets we set ourselves, but not really something which decide whether we are peaceful or not. With what I said so far, this peace, which can be experienced by the mind, can be there even when there are desires. Another point about this way of trying to see satisfaction is, with time, this will become one's nature. Just because I said we have enough reasons to be happy, so we can be happy, it does not mean that as the situation changes and we lose a few reasons to be happy, our level of happiness or satisfaction can reduce. Because when this becomes your nature, you will always look for positives, and so this peace that you feel will stop depending on situations outside. You will be in a state of self-satisfaction. And I think that gives us another hint. The more and more we are able to do actions seeking this self-satisfaction, we are likely to find more peace. And I had spoken about this in reply to another question too. How we truly feel satisfaction and a kind of peace only when we follow our conscience. Which means there is a certain peace that comes with doing the right actions. A peace that comes with following values. Even this state of peace can have desires in it, like desires to do good, desire to see people happy, desires to see someone's pain relieved. In fact, these desires, though can lead to restlessness, these desires also come with the inherent satisfaction. There's another connection between doing actions to satisfy one's conscience and what Swami told about the statement, "I want peace." Swami said, "Remove desire and remove ego." One of the ways in which this ego can be removed is to do actions more and more to satisfy the conscience. See, the actions that we do every day are of three types. Actions to satisfy the body, which include eating, resting, protecting the body from the weather and any such activities. These we perform in response to the body's indications. Then there are actions that we perform to satisfy the mind. We do things to earn a good name, do things to be respected by others. We do actions that satisfy the cravings of the mind. For instance, for the need of the body, what you need is just a pair of clothes, but the mind desires for branded clothes. So that way we perform actions constantly to satisfy the mind and body. And when we do so, we are associating our true self with the body and mind. All these actions are born of the feeling, I am the body and I am the mind. And this is nothing but ego. One way to give up this ego is increase the number of actions that we do which arise from the feeling, let's say, I am the soul. Which are nothing but actions performed to satisfy one's conscience or to please the Swami sitting inside, as you wish to see it. This includes what we call random acts of kindness too. When you do some help for a person with no selfishness, just for that inner satisfaction, you are acting to satisfy your soul. So the more we do actions for self-satisfaction or pleasing the voice of conscience, the more we remove our ego or identification with the body and mind. And the more we give up our ego, the more we find peace. So the question that Brother Naresh has asked, if we do not have any desire at that particular moment, when we feel peace, then who are we at that particular moment? I would say it is not necessary that if you are feeling peace for a few moments, you have transcended your ego completely. In fact, this idea that I am so and so is superimposed on the truth that I am divine. That is why we have that pond analogy. Imagine your reality to be in the bottom of that pond. As long as the ripples are there, the bottom is not clearly visible. But that does not mean that the bottom has vanished. It was always there and it will continue to be there. Similarly, this idea that I am divine is always present. The desires mask this truth. So it is not that when restless, I am the body, and when at peace, I am someone else. When at peace, I am in fact revealing the true self that is always there. So I think that answers the questions that were asked. But when at the topic, I think I should mention this point too. As we defined so far, peace can be really experienced when there is an acceptance of things just as they are. When I accept what I have, when I can even accept that right now I have a desire, and I also accept that it does not matter if the desire is fulfilled or not. There is complete acceptance. And this comes very, very easily when one surrenders to God. When there is surrender, you don't even have to think of getting rid of desires or even worry about your ego. This process of surrender deals with all of it. And the best explanation of surrender Swami has given is, whatever comes your way, accept it with a feeling that it is good for me. Let us say a desire arises in my mind, and I tell myself, oh, this is a desire, I don't want to have this desire. Aren't you now creating a new desire? We describe desire as a state where you cannot accept the present and are seeking a change. So when I have a desire and I say, no, there should not be a desire, even that becomes a craving for what is not the present state. But through this process of surrender, when you accept all that comes to you and offer every moment of your life as it is to God, there is a complete acceptance. Acceptance of your state before the desire came, acceptance if the desire is satisfied or not satisfied, and the acceptance of the desire itself. But needless to say, this sort of devotion will lead to all low desires vanishing over a period of time. So if you really wish to find peace, forget desires, satisfying them or giving them up, just develop surrender to God. So to summarize whatever I've said so far, yes, there is a close correlation between desires and peace. Where there is desire, there is a likelihood that there will be restlessness. But from that we can draw the idea that when a desire is satisfied, one can have peace. But problem with desire is, the more you keep fulfilling it, the more desires will arise. So the best thing to do is to remove desires. The other approach is to concentrate on the satisfaction part. There are many things that we possess, material and otherwise, which others crave for, which others desire for. Can we be grateful for them and remind ourselves of our fortune? That way we are mentally acknowledging the many reasons we have to be satisfied, and we can experience the peace that comes after the satisfaction of a desire. With time, this will become one's nature. And this peace will become independent of desires, their fulfillments, or even our possessions. The other point we can derive from this fact that satisfaction gives peace is to do more and more actions for self-satisfaction. One of the main causes for a disturbed mind is a pricking conscience. So the more we do actions and follow our conscience, it will automatically result in self-satisfaction and peace. This is also a means of subduing one's ego, as I explained. So in the process, we go through what Swami says is the best way to attain peace. Remove ego and remove desires, and you will have peace. So this statement of Swami is true for what I described as the peace that can be experienced through the mind and the peace that can be experienced beyond the mind. When we go through the process, the mind experiences the peace. But when this process is complete, the ego and desires are completely annihilated and we will find the supreme peace. And yes, at that moment, you will have no identification with your body and personality. So thank you for that question, Brother Naresh from Nepal. If you have any more clarifications based on what I said, you can always write to me at prem@radiosai.org. With that, dear listeners, it's time to wind up on this segment of Radio Sai Answering Booth. Thank brothers Vineet and Naresh for their questions. If any of you have a question that you would like me to answer, a question on practical applications of Swami's message or spirituality in general, you can send them to me. You can mail me at prem@radiosci.org. That's prem@radiosci.org. That is my personal mail ID, so the questions that you send to me will be read by me alone, just in case you wish to be anonymous. And as I always say, it would be wonderful if you can record your questions and send them to me. I most lovingly offer this segment at Swami's Lotus Feet. Thank you for joining me. Do join me again next week too on Radio Sai's Answering Booth.